This is Townships Talkback, conversations on current affairs here in the Eastern Townships. I'm your host, David Teasdale. Today, I'm talking with Eamon Awida, Assistant Professor of Nuclear Medicine at the University of Sherbrooke, former Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of Colorado, former Medical Physicist at Montreal General Hospital. Today, I will be speaking to him about his family in the Gaza and the impact that the conflict is having on him and his family. Welcome to CJMQ. Now, we're talking today not about your research, which is very fascinating, but more about Palestine, Gaza, and the situation there.
That's right. Yes, it's unfortunate. Maybe in the future we'll have some better days to talk about research.
Yes, yes. Now, you have family in the region, and you are from the region.
That's right, yes. I've been to Gaza quite a few times. I haven't lived there. My parents left before I was born, so we visit often just to visit cousins and aunts and uncles and so on.
Yes, yeah, close family members still in the region. It must have a huge impact on you, what is going on right now.
Absolutely, and I still have contact with a lot of my cousins. I mean, I have really strong friendships with a lot of relatives there. I have maybe six uncles and nine aunts in Gaza, and each of them has children. The ones that are closer to my age are the ones that I'm closest to, and I maintain contact with them. It's quite depressing. It's quite stressful.
Yes, I'm sure.
From my father's side, he had cousins who were killed. They were women. They were in their 70s. And they were killed from point blank. It wasn't, you know, like a bomb coming from the top. It was soldiers shooting at them. And so it's been quite traumatic for people there, but also here, as sometimes we don't have enough communication. Oftentimes the networks there are not good. We lose connection and we're quite concerned and worried about, you know, their fate, where they are. Are they eating? Are they alive? How are the children doing? My cousin had children who were sick for some time. And it's been quite a roller coaster of emotions and quite a difficult time.
Now, just so that people understand the region, those who don't understand, we're talking about the Gaza, what they call the Gaza Strip, and which is in the Middle East. And it's very complicated for outsiders to understand exactly when we talk about that. What is the difference between Gaza, Palestine, and Israel, and how those, I guess, they all overlap?
Right. I mean, it's you're right. For an outsider, I didn't think it was as complicated as maybe it's presented as. But as this issue evolved and became center and headline news, a lot of people were asking, you know, similar questions. And in my mind, and in a lot of our minds as Palestinians or people of Palestinian origin, especially for those who were evicted from their homes, such as my grandparents. So my grandparents were in what is now Israel, but were evicted from their homes, became refugees in the Gaza Strip. So there's the Gaza Strip and there's the Gaza City. And so when we talk about, it's like saying Quebec as a province and then Quebec City as the capital.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that could be confusing actually as well.
Yeah, so so Gaza City is actually where the concentration of the most Palestinians are, isn't it?
That's right, yes. And when the war started and Israel was saying people should displace to the south, they meant the southern part of the Gaza Strip where there are other cities such as Rafah. Now, Rafah is the main one that's being that's coming up now in the news because it's on the border with Egypt, and that's where nearly a million and a half displaced Gazans are sitting now in tents and schools. But yeah, so for a lot of Palestinians, we still have this inherited, I don't know if it's trauma, but just inherited knowledge of our ancestral land, of our homes. I mean, my father remembers quite well. My oldest uncle, who still lives in Beersheba, Beersheba is now in Israel, still remembers his own home. a lot of us have even keys, like my parents and grandparents would have keys to their old homes, and they would hang them on the walls. And so when Israel came into existence, there was a lot of suffering from the Palestinian side. And there was the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which are two pieces of land where a lot of the Palestinians are. They're not connected with each other, and that's why they're geographically separated. One is on Israeli, controlled by Israel, which is the West Bank, and Gaza is not. Gaza is just Palestinians living there.
Okay, so I didn't understand that either.
That
it is confusing.
So if we put it maybe a little simpler, if we were to imagine a better future of a Palestinian state, because since this conflict started 75 years ago, there was this assumption that, not an assumption, it was really supposed to happen, it hasn't happened, that there would be a Palestinian state. And this is what when we talk about a two-state solution, this is exactly what we mean, that there would be an Israeli state as it is, and there would be a Palestinian state. So if we think of a better future, we would imagine the West Bank and Gaza being connected with each other and being called Palestine, and people would fly in and out of Palestine. They would, there would be some level of self-determination, autonomy.
Yes.
For this nation that would be called Palestine.
That just
seems, right now it's just, yeah.
It seems to make so much sense. What is the opposition to that? I don't understand.
Nor do I, honestly. This is where a lot of us will surrender to the geopolitics of today's world and how superpowers such as the United States would like to see the geography of this region, or Israel in particular, because now Israel is the stronger power in the Middle East. It seems like it's at the fate of the more powerful and not at the fate of what is more just and what is more, what takes into consideration the civilians and people's lives.
But in the long term, doesn't it? It seems logical to me that in the long term, it has to come to a two-state solution, does it not? I mean, how is peace ever going to manage to have a chance to survive in the Middle East without a two-state solution?
100%. Absolutely. 100%. And I think this is where the multi-layered complexity of the situation starts to take shape for people who don't understand the region quite well. But yes, ultimately, this should be the state. This is what even Canada and many countries in Europe and so on have called for, that the two-state solution, the existence of the state of Palestine, two nations living side by side, each to their own. To their own.
It just seems like the only logical conclusion that has any chance of success at all, to me.
That's true. And I think we're headed, I hope we're headed in that direction, given how things have unfolded over the last 4 months. The violence, violence will not stop, and it will continue, and people will want to fight for this, their rights, they see as their right to establish this land.
And then there's retribution. And then retribution for the retribution, and it just goes on.
And so on. Absolutely.
What is the situation now? Like, you were mentioning that people were told to move to the south. Now, I had heard that in the news reports, and then I'd also heard that there was nothing for them to move to in the south, or no place for them to go to the south. And you mentioned that it's close to the border of Egypt. Now, are people able to have a chance to get out of harm's way?
That's also complex, because at the beginning, they said people should move to the south. And so I have some family who was able to move to the south, and I have some family who could not move to the south. So for those who did, oftentimes there were shellings and bombings around them, and they saw people get killed in those areas in the south, where Israel still has tanks on the ground, soldiers on the ground, and is flying bomber jets as well, and it has not been safe in those regions where my cousins, the ones who went to the south, are. But the ones who stayed behind have to stay behind because they couldn't. They couldn't find means of transportation. Either one of my uncles was quite sick and fragile and couldn't move. Mm-hmm. And so you had many cases of people who neither had the means nor the health nor the capability to move to the south. And so what do you do then? Do you just ignore that there are civilians in that region and continue doing what you wanted to do? Or do you take them into consideration? And I think there is, these rules around how war should be conducted. And I am certain that these rules have been broken. And this is why we see a case of in front of the International Criminal Court of Justice now for a plausible genocide by Israel. Mm-hmm. So overall, the family that stayed behind is now suffering. They have no food. I'm still in touch with one of them, although without internet, I have to call their telephone directly.
Yes.
And it's only once in a few days that it'll connect. But he tells me of, you know, having my grandfather's home where they are all housed right now, two uncles and their kids and their grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
He tells me how he and his cousin go out every day just in search of a bag of flour. Sometimes sacrificing so much, like walking for a long period of time, and then reaching an area where there are a lot of troops who would shoot at them to tell them you should go back and not come to this area, even though it's in that area or just after that area where the food would be.
Oh.
It's a big struggle.
It's a terrible situation. And how can someone... It's heartbreaking to listen to, especially if there's nothing you can actually do. And I guess that's the feeling that I have and a lot of people have. It's heartbreaking, right. And it's more heartbreaking when you can't actually do anything. How can someone help?
Great point, because that's something that, as someone who has family there, I struggled with a lot, but then I found out that a lot of people actually, have, and it's not surprising. A lot of people do have compassion and empathy and want to do something. They don't want to just sit there and watch.
Yes.
So on a first level, I guess, from the minute this conflict erupted, from the first few days, I guess, we started lobbying government, and petitions were created to support Palestinians and their will to have a state. And so there's a lot of lobbying that needs to take place. And now much more lobbying takes place to stop Israel from having access to arms in the Gaza Strip against civilians. So there's some work. And then actually that's another point that I forgot to mention. When a war erupts, usually people will seek refuge. So they'll have refugees. People will be displaced outside of their own country.
Yes.
And that's something that Palestinians don't have access to, that, kind of like in Ukraine where you have access to a border and you can just get out of that border and seek refuge in a neighboring country. And Canada welcomed many refugees also from Ukraine. And
yes.
one of the things that first few weeks was apparent was we need to allow Palestinians to leave Gaza, the civilians, so that they can seek refuge in another country.
Why can't they?
So, yeah, and that became quite an ordeal because there are two borders, one with Egypt and one with Israel. And the one with Egypt is actually controlled by Israel. No Palestinian can leave from the Israeli side, from the Gaza Strip. Israel does not allow them to go through Israel to leave Gaza.
Oh.
And seek refuge in Israel, for example, right? No Gazans are allowed to go into Israel. And then Egypt says, no, we're not taking the Gazans in either. This problem has to be solved between Palestine and Israel.
So how can we help the people who are suffering right now? I know that's on everyone's mind.
Yeah. Yes, I went on a tangent there. So besides the lobbying, the other part is financial. And so there are many nonprofit organizations that are, including United Nations organizations, that are doing a lot of good work on the ground over there. And people are receiving the aid, except it's in very small amounts, and not always to the people who need it the most, because the people in the north of Gaza, need it the most.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not easy for the trucks to get to those areas. Nevertheless, people do receive that aid. And then a lot of Palestinians, you know, if anyone knows a Palestinian with origins in Gaza or has relatives in Gaza, we're able to send money into Gaza to our own relatives, who mm-hmm. then help others and help themselves, of course, to buy, you know, some of the most basic necessities, such as water, which is now in scarcity. That's another way. It's to offer support to people you might know, people in your groups. There's a lot of GoFundMe pages now that are up there. I created one myself as well to support family and relatives there. It's been going quite well, actually, on my side. You know, for the first 3 months, I never thought I would do a GoFundMe page. I just felt like it's something that, you know, I would never want to put my hand out there. But then we as a family, me, my father, my mother, my kids, whoever, mm-hmm. we put all the money we could to help our relatives there.
Well, yes,
and
of course.
We saw it made a difference. We saw that they used that money to go to a dentist for my son, my cousin's son, who had a lot of tooth pain, but they had no money because they left their home. They left everything in their home closed. So, but you're able to transfer funds to these, such as Western Union. So there are some smaller stores there that have a Western Union branch. They receive that money. They're able to use it. They're able to find, you know, for example, the aid that comes in terms of food comes in the form of soup, mm-hmm. but now they're able to buy fruits and vegetables, which are not very common, but they're there at high prices.
I see. Yeah.
So those are the kinds of things I would do.
There is a Western Union here in Sherbrooke. I drive by it every
There's
day.
There's a few.
There are a few. I know of one, but it's so important for people who feel like I feel, like, to find some way to be able to actually do something concrete. And so that's great. Now, you're saying there are some GoFundMes that I suppose doing a search on Palestinian relief or something like that would direct a person there.
Yeah, and you'll find Canadians doing these GoFundMe things as well mm-hmm. on the GoFundMe page directly.
Now, is there something that I haven't touched on that you would like to mention?
I just hope that this will end. I mean, we're on the doorsteps of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan.
Oh yes,
which
yes.
is a big day for a big month for Muslims and for all of the people in Gaza, almost all the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, you know, a few months ago, they were saying the war will end in a month. And then a month ago, they were saying the war will end in a few weeks just before Ramadan. And now they are so discouraged when I talk to my cousin, so depressed and disappointed that Monday is the first day of Ramadan. And it seems guaranteed that they'll still be in tents and in schools and not back in their homes, which is where they would have liked to be during this month.
Is there any hope on the horizon? Do you see any glimmer of hope on the horizon for a resolution to this?
It's no. It's in the immediate sense. Like no one. It's really hard to predict. You know when this will end. There's mm-hmm. this hope that somehow one day we'll wake up and there will be an agreement that this war is over. But the hope that we had early on has faded away, and almost nothing. None of it is left now. So we're no longer living on hope. We're just kind of. Supporting each other, myself and my cousins in Gaza, as much as we can by being on the phone, by listening to each other's stories and thinking of better days ahead.
Yes, that's so important to share this story and share it with those of us who would like to understand more about what is going on. But admittedly, unless you have a connection to the region, it is complicated and a little difficult to understand.
Yes.
And of course, you hear so much that you wonder, you know, how much of it is accurate.
What's right and what's wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's very hard to know. So I really appreciate talking to someone who has connections to the region and can help demystify that. You're from Sherbrooke, right?
Yes, I'm Sherbrooke.
Yeah. So, very pleased to talk with you. I wish it was happier circumstances. And maybe in the future we will talk on happier things, hopefully very soon. Absolutely. About the region. I'd love to talk to you again when there is a development one way or the other, you know, keep in touch and let people know how they can help. I think that's about the only thing we can do, eh?
Absolutely. I will. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to speak with you. I hope some people up there will be able to relate to this and have a better, clearer picture of the situation now.
I hope so, too. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Eamon Oweda, the Assistant Professor of Nuclear Medicine at Université de Sherbrooke, talking to us about his family in the Gaza. You're listening to Townships Talk Back, Conversations on Current Affairs on CJMQ 88.9 FM.
The battle will be over. There will be no more. battle will be over.